Democracy Now! Has two job openings. We have a job opening for an administrative director, as well as a Linux systems administrator and fall internships. Visit democracynow.org/jobs for more information. Democracy Now! Is produced by a remarkable group of people. Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nerman Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Mike DeFilippo, and Miguel Nogueira are our engineers. A special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, Jessica Lee, John Wallach, Dennis Moynihan, and John Hamilton. You can watch, listen to, and read all of our transcripts for all of our shows. We'll be broadcasting from Deutsche Welle tomorrow as well. That's Tuesday. Tell your friends. Send word around. Democracy Now! Is independent global news. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much to Deutsche Welle for hosting us for this news hour. Thanks for joining us from Bonn, Germany.
This is Ramona Africa, and you're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 on your dial. KBOO is the exact example of the community taking charge of itself. On the move.
Tune in to KBOO for the 27th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival. KBOO will again broadcast the entire festival from noon to 10 p.m., July 3rd through the 6th. The broadcast will also be carried by various stations of Oregon Community Media for statewide coverage of this Oregon Food Bank Benefit Festival. Again, July 3rd through the 6th, noon to 10 p.m. each day here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Sex Workers film series, which on Saturday, July 5th at 7 p.m. will show The Price of Sex. This feature-length documentary sheds light on the underground criminal network of human trafficking and the experiences of trafficked Eastern European women forced into prostitution abroad. The Price of Sex includes first-person accounts, as well as interviews with traffickers, clients, and anti-trafficking activists to expose the root causes, complex connections, and stark significance of sexual slavery today. Again, that's Saturday, July 5th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland activist arrested for blocking train track with her arm chained to a cement block.
The U.S. Supreme Court has been very busy today. We have several stories for you coming up.
4th of July DUI checkpoints will force blood test.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, June 30th, 2014. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Rosalyn Scott. A Portland activist was arrested this morning for blocking railroad tracks in protest of oil trains. Irene Maggiore of the group Portland Rising Tide cemented her hand inside a barrel and attempted to block the path for trains leading into the archaeologist crude oil terminal in the northwest Portland. Marjorie's arm was locked to a piece of metal rebar embedded in the barrel. According to Police Bureau spokesman Sergeant Pete Simpson, officers were called to the track shortly after 5 a.m. and found Maggiore about 15 or 20 supporters. Simpson said the bomb squad cut Maggiore free and arrested her for criminal trespassing, criminal mischief, and disorderly conduct. A spokesperson for Portland Rising Tide said that oil trains are hazardous and fossil fuels threaten the climate. U.S. crude oil production has risen in the past few years from around 5 million barrels per day to around 7 million barrels per day. Increased extraction in North Dakota's Bakken Shale has resulted in a dramatic rise in oil train traffic, with 250% more oil trains traveling Oregon rail lines in 2013 than in the previous year. We'll have a live studio interview with Portland Rising Tide activist Irene Majerie after this newscast. Stay tuned.
A full-size cougar was spotted yesterday in southeast Portland, headed north across Division Street at 122nd Avenue. It's unknown if this is the same cougar spotted on North Killingsworth a couple of weeks ago. In yesterday's sighting, two callers reported seeing the cougar crossing Division and heading into the neighborhood. Several officers checked the area but did not locate the cougar. According to the Oregon Department of Wildlife, if you encounter a cougar, stop, stay calm, do not turn your back, and do not run away. While there have been no other reported cougar sightings, the Portland Police Bureau would like community members to be aware of this possible sighting, and they encourage anyone seeing a cougar not to approach it, but to immediately call 911.
The Oregon Department of Agriculture has approved $150,000 to help protect gray wolves. The money will go to farmers and ranchers who suffer losses due to wolves. It will also help pay for non-lethal techniques to help stop wolf attacks. Eight Oregon counties, which are known areas of wolf activity, will receive the funding. Last year, just two counties experienced incidents of livestock being killed or injured by wolves. The ranchers were compensated a total of $8,000. The rest of last year's $34,000 of wolf mitigation funding was divided among eight counties to distribute to ranchers who had missing livestock above the average rate. This year, over $100,000 will be spent on prevention of wolf attacks. These include quick removal of bone piles and carcasses, construction of barriers like fences and electric boundaries, and guard dogs. The number of known wolves in Oregon has increased to 64 wolves at the end of 2013. This is up from 46 wolves in 2012.
Scientists already knew that monarch butterflies can navigate by the sun, but a new study shows they can also use the Earth's magnetic field, just like a compass. The scientists observe the flight of the butterflies in a chamber and observe that their flight patterns correspond to a changing magnetic field. This can explain how they find their way on very cloudy days. This is monarch season in the Pacific Northwest. Keep on the lookout.
One way to see nature up close and personal is to put on a life jacket and slide in it into a canoe or kayak. This summer, water tours are available in English and Spanish at the Salitz National Wildlife Refuge as part of an outreach effort to encourage Spanish-speaking visitors. KBOO's Alexi Horowitz has more in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
A summer visit to a national park or wildlife refuge can be a challenge when the visitors don't speak English. So, at the Salitz Bay National Wildlife Refuge near Lincoln City, this summer includes bilingual canoe and kayak tours. The free 2-hour trips offer an introduction to the area's natural history and wildlife, and for some, a first chance to paddle. Lucila Fernandez at the refuge says there are routes for novices on the water as well as more experienced kayakers. Either way, she says, it's a much different wildlife watching experience than at a city park or zoo.
You get to see bald eagles and turkey vultures and swifts all doing their thing out in nature. There's one point in the kayak tour, which is probably one of my favorites, where you cross under the 101 bridge. You get to hear the song of at least three different types of flycatchers.
Tours are scheduled for July, on the 3rd, 7th, and 18th, but Fernandez says the refuge staff can accommodate groups on other dates with some advance notice, through mid-August. For safety, the maximum tour size is 10 people at a time. People can bring their own canoes or kayaks or rent them in the Lincoln City area. Fernandez is part of Environment for the Americas, a nonprofit group with a goal of increasing diversity in areas of science. She says the group's research has found Latino families enjoy outdoor recreation as much as anyone else, but they often don't know what's available in their area, or when they get there, it can be harder to relax and fit in.
If there's anyone available who's speaking Spanish, there's anyone available who is coming from that culture. The signs in a lot of parks are not in Spanish. So it's not as inviting or welcoming for someone not of the larger culture.
The summer, Bilingual Environment for the Americas interns are focused on introducing more people to the importance of migratory birds. They're working with the BLM and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service at multiple sites along the Pacific Flyway. For KBOO News, this is Alexi Horowitz.
Jefferson County School District officials are working with Oregon State University to increase teacher diversity. The student population in Jefferson County is one-third American Indian, one-third Hispanic, and one-third white. However, the teaching workforce in Jefferson County is more than 30% white. According to Carolyn Platt, OSU's program lead for teacher education, research shows that student engagement, motivation, and success is increased when students see role models in teaching positions who reflect or understand their background. Jefferson County Superintendent Rick Molitor agreed. "We want our staff and teachers to be in line with the demographics of our students, and it's something we're striving for, but," he added, "we don't have the applicants." As part of the initiative, OSU is offering scholarships to students from underrepresented populations for its Cascade Campus Master in Teaching program. The demographic gap between students and teachers is an issue not only in Central Oregon. More than one-third of Oregon students are minorities, compared with 8% of teachers. The state has set a goal of getting the teacher workforce up to 10% by 2015.
Tomorrow could be the Portland metropolitan area's warmest day of the year, topping the high of 91 this year on May 14th. Temperatures will hit the mid to upper 90s Tuesday as a result of high pressure in a thermal trough. Thermal troughs are areas of low pressure caused by very warm, dry air. These troughs often form along the Oregon coast in summer, creating offshore flow that brings warmer and drier air than normal into western Oregon from east of the Cascades. Cooler marine air will begin to arrive Wednesday, bringing Portland high temperatures down 15 to 20 degrees on Thursday and Friday. That should make for a dry and comfortable 4th of July holiday on Friday, with highs around 75.
Portland Parks Commissioner Amanda Fritz will discuss her parks replacement bond proposal tonight at a community town hall. The town hall takes place at Cleveland High School, located at 3400 Southeast 26th Avenue in Portland. At the public hearing, Fritz will announce specific examples of critical projects that could be funded if voters approve the bond this fall. These projects include repairing or replacing 10 to 20 neighborhood playgrounds at risk of failing, repairing several community swimming pools to prevent emergency closures, and repairing trails and bridges to preserve access to natural areas and open spaces like Forest Park. A recent Portland Parks and Recreation survey shows support for the parks replacement bond, which would increase funding for repairs in Portland's parks without increasing property taxes. Right now, property owners in Portland pay close to 8 cents for every $1,000 of assessed property value for a bond measure that supports the city's park system. That bond was passed in 1994 and is set to expire this year unless voters approve a replacement measure in November. If the 1994 bond expires in 2015 and is not replaced, the annual property tax rate paid by a typical homeowner with a home valued at $150,000 would decrease by $13. Replacing the expiring bond would generate up to $68 million to fund critical repairs. These repairs would include the replacement of deteriorating playgrounds, reopening and stabilizing trails, and repairing community swimming pools to prevent emergency closures.
Eugene listeners will be interested to know that if they're stopped at a police checkpoint this coming weekend, they had better agree to perform a breathalyzer test or risk being forced to have their blood drawn by the police. During the coming holiday weekend in Eugene, police will implement a policy to forcibly draw blood from people who refuse to take an alcohol breathalyzer test. The so-called no-refusal policy will likely result in people being strapped down to gurneys and forced to have their blood drawn. That's been the result of no-refusal policies in other cities where they've been implemented. Driving under the influence is a misdemeanor charge. Forced blood tests are not required for any other misdemeanor charges, including drug possession. But they are allowed for people suspected of drunk driving. In Georgia, forced blood draw has become a standard practice over the last several years, but lawyers there have challenged the practice as unconstitutional. Bob Chesney is an Atlanta-based lawyer who has filed legal challenges to the practice of forced blood draws. He spoke with KABU about the practice today.
To give you a little history, Georgia, of course, has an implied consent law like every other state in the country where once a person's under arrest for DUI, they're given the choice of submitting to a blood or breath test or refusing and suffering a suspension of their license and probably the use of the refusal in court during trial. In 2005, our Georgia Supreme Court held that once a person has decided to refuse that testing, even though he may suffer a suspension, that the police were prohibited from then getting a search warrant and forcing the person to submit to a blood test. In other words, the police had to honor the person's refusal. In 2006, our Georgia legislature amended our implied consent law purportedly to allow the police to follow up a refusal with a search warrant and compel the testing. But in doing so, the legislature left the language in the statute that said, if you refuse, then no test shall be given. So it seems to leave it ambiguous at best as to whether the police can follow up the practice of first reading you the implied consent, seeing if you refuse, and then if you do, go get a search warrant to get your blood anyway. And that's the way we're challenging the use. It is fairly widespread in Georgia now that the police are, if they choose to, applying for a search warrant to get blood if the person refuses an initial breath test.
How does that procedure work? Are people, how do they draw the blood?
Well, it varies from county to county. Some counties are humane enough to take somebody to the hospital and take the signed search warrant, show a nurse a search warrant that authorizes him or her to draw the blood, and then they proceed to take the blood, and if necessary, they'll enlist hospital personnel and or law enforcement personnel to actually hold the person down if necessary. Most people acquiesce once they're told that they're going to have the blood drawn regardless. And in some counties, they actually do it at the jail, as horrendous as that may sound.
That was Bob Chesney speaking to us from Georgia, where he is one of a group of lawyers that are challenging the practice of forced blood draws. In Oregon, no lawyers have filed a challenge, and the ACLU told reporters that as long as the police get a search warrant for the blood, they are within the law. But other civil liberties advocates say that strapping people down to a gurney and forcing them to submit to a blood draw is a violation of the Fourth Amendment ban on illegal search and seizure.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a live interview with Portland Rising Tide activists who blocked an oil train shipment early this morning, followed by Labor Radio at 6 p.m. Tonight's Labor Radio features an interview with Susan L. Stoner, author of the Sage Adair, Historical Mysteries of the Pacific Northwest. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Hear Karen James interview Mary Graham, whose husband was shot and killed by the Clackamas County Sheriff after serving 20 years in prison. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will bring a bright, sunny 95-degree day. Summer has arrived. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 15 counts per minute in Southeast Portland, 21 counts per minute in Vancouver, Washington. Eugene, Oregon has a count of 31 CPM, and North Vancouver, British Columbia has a current radiation count of 30 counts per minute. Counts per minute is a measurement of ionizing radiation events registered by an instrument known as a Geiger counter. Radcast alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org.
It's 5:20. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
What a hoot to see House Speaker John Boehner up on his hind legs, braying like a goofy mule, and declaring that by gollies, he's filing suit against President Obama for, quote, aggressive unilateralism. Or was it unilateral aggressivism? Whatever. Speaker Boehner says it's an outrage, I tell you, that a president would issue executive orders to take assorted actions without the approval of Congress, specifically things that Boehner does not approve of. Everywhere I go, spaketh the speaker, I'm asked, when will the House stand up on behalf of the people to stop the encroachment of executive power under President Obama? Really? Everywhere? That's the question he gets? Maybe he needs to get around to more places. I think he'd find that most people are more concerned about the falling middle class, rising poverty, inequality, climate change, senseless wars, and even the failure of his own leadership to address these real-life issues. Nonetheless, Boehner is suing Obama for his, quote, effort to erode the power of the legislative branch. But wait, let's check the numbers. So far, Obama's White House has issued 168 presidential orders. Yet George W. Bush was far more outrageous, using this power 291 times. Did Boehner try to sue George W. for aggressive unilateralism? No, no. He endorsed many of the Republicans' executive excesses, even writing to Bush in 2008, pleading with him to exercise that presidential power for a national emergency, namely exempting a steamboat in his state from safety regulations. This is Jim Hightower saying, what about Reagan's 381 executive orders, Nixon's 346, Eisenhower's 484, and on and on? I happen to oppose the use of these orders, but I also oppose using them to play crass partisan politics, as this silly speaker is doing.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
And now, we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
No court case is going to stand in the way of home care workers coming together to have a strong voice for good jobs and quality home care. Today, we are more determined than ever to keep uniting.
SEIU President Mary Kay Henry, reacting to the U.S. Supreme Court Harris versus Quinn decision, the court ruled that home care workers in Illinois who are not members of SEIU can no longer be required to pay fair share fees to the union for collective bargaining services. The Supreme Court said that violates the First Amendment. Lisa Madigan is Illinois Attorney General.
In our experience, allowing home health care workers to have an exclusive bargaining representative has proven to reduce turnover, enhance stability, and improve working conditions. This has been extremely positive for both the recipients of care and for home health care workers, but significantly, it has been very positive for the state. Illinois saves over $600 million a year providing people services in their homes where they have an independence and autonomy that they wouldn't have if they were institutionalized.
SEIU's Mary Kay Henry says that a majority of the home care workers in Illinois are members of the union, and SEIU will forge a new model to make sure home care workers continue to be organized.
We are confident that we are going to be able to continue to advocate for ourselves, for seniors and the disabled with the existing model, but we are also committed to joining hands with the state of Illinois, consumer advocates in the senior and disability communities to figure out another way. Just like we figured out this way 13 years ago, we're going to figure out the next way now.
The U.S. Supreme Court says if your health care is against your boss's religion, the boss can exclude it from your employer-provided health care benefit if you're a woman needing birth control.
Bosses should stick to what they know best, the boardroom and the bottom line, and stay out of the bedroom and the exam room.
National Women's Law Center co-president Marcia Greenberger. The 5-4 decision Monday handed a victory to Hobby Lobby and a defeat to women workers' health care. Greenberger says women will continue to stand up and fight for their health care rights despite this decision.
We know that women will have to and will continue to fight for what is right, for affordable birth control, and for autonomy over their own health care decisions, and that this Supreme Court interpretation by 5 justices over a very ringing dissent by 4 justices will not stand in the political arena when women stand up for their rights.
Not a single woman Supreme Court justice bought the idea that bosses can use religious beliefs to deny women employees health coverage. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
According to a revenue report released today, tax revenues in Kansas fell $28 million short of projections in June, pushing the shortfall for the fiscal year that ended Monday to nearly $338 million. Democrats blame the lower collections on Governor Sam Brownback's tax cuts in 2012 and 2013. However, Governor Brownback's administration claims the disappointing numbers are a result of federal tax and spending policies. House Minority Leader Paul Davis, the presumed Democratic nominee for governor, said Kansas is an anomaly in that it is seeing declines in income tax collections related to federal tax policies not seen elsewhere in the nation. Governor Brownback has been claiming success for his economic program, particularly several rounds of income tax cuts amounting to the largest in the state's history. But job creation in Kansas has remained essentially flat since last fall, even as employment increased in the rest of the country. Davis said that, if elected governor, he will pursue a big increase in education spending and a postponement of scheduled income tax cuts in an effort to improve the state economy.
The U.S. Supreme Court ruled today that home care workers in Illinois can opt out of paying fees to a union that represents all home care workers in the state. The court's decision dealt with workers who aren't directly employed by government, but are supported by public funds. It's unclear how it would apply to home care workers here in Oregon. For more, KBOO's Janka Soderberg spoke with Rob Sisk, the president of SEIU Local 503 OPEU, which is an Oregon union representing tens of thousands of home health and child care workers.
I wonder if you can start by telling us what you think is the implication locally of today's Supreme Court decision about home care workers in Illinois.
Well, first of all, it's very clear, at least is our determination, that this is going to be focused mainly on what happened in Illinois. What we're concerned about mainly is making sure that our home care workers here in Oregon continue to see the union as a way to improve their lot. I don't know if you know this, but so many home care workers have been at poverty wages and doing essential work, and what we've been trying to do is fight for them to make a more decent living, which not only improves their lot, but also improves the services that they're providing for the people they take care of by keeping the wages up, getting them up to where they should be, although they're still not at the point where they should be, and also ensuring there's less turnover and just that the quality of the work is good, and that the care they provide is good. So right now we're waiting to see what the implications are for our home care workers in Oregon.
Who does the SEIU Local 503 represent? What kind of work do they do?
Well, first of all, we represent a wide range of workers. We represent state workers. We represent workers in the higher ed system. We represent local governments, different cities, different counties. We represent nonprofits. We represent workers in nursing homes. So, and we also represent, of course, the home care workers and child care workers and adult foster care workers. So that's a wide range of members that we represent. And this is, home care workers are a large part of our union. Or at least care providers as a whole are almost half of our membership.
And the home care workers, as I understand it, allow people who are elderly or disabled to stay at home rather than going to a nursing home, which would end up costing the state and that person a lot more?
Yes, that's correct. It's not only good for what we call the consumers, the people they care for. That's the technical term for the people they care for. Not only good because their quality of life is enhanced either through care in the home or at least in a family type of setting, a more personalized setting, and it is cost effective for the state. So therefore, the citizens of the state of Oregon benefit not only from that quality of care, but also from a lower cost for it.
Now, one of the things that's come out in the aftermath of today's ruling is that Portland attorney Jill Gibson has announced that she was waiting for today's decision to draft a new measure for the 2016 ballot to give all public employees the right to opt out of paying union dues. And I wonder if you could talk about the implication of that, if that moves forward.
It's news to me. Nonetheless, in this particular climate where it seems like the deck is stacked against workers in this country, and there is a faction in this country who seems to want to take down unions and keep workers marginalized and control how much they make and keep benefits either non-existent or minimal, that this should be something that's being planned again. We will fight any attempt that compromises workers being able to stand up for themselves and to organize and join a union, because that is where so many of them are going to find their welfare protected or bettered. So we will continue to fight for a better working conditions, better pay, better benefits for workers throughout the state.
Well, I do want to thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Rob Sisk. He is the president of the SEIU Local 503, represents home care workers in the state of Oregon. This is Jinka Soderberg with KBOO News.
The U.S. Supreme Court will not decide if Google violated laws by collecting personal data with Street View photographs. The issue is that when Google Street Mapping was taking photographs, they were also listening to unprotected Wi-Fi networks and collecting personal data. That data included emails, passwords, web history, and text messages. Google has stopped that practice. In March 2014, Google agreed to pay a $7 million fine for collecting this personal data, but appealed. A Google spokesman expressed disappointment that the Supreme Court has declined to hear the case.
Last year, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld a California law prohibiting so-called conversion therapy, or trying to cure people of homosexuality. With that decision, the plaintiffs in the case took it to the U.S. Supreme Court. Today, the Supreme Court refused to rule on the appeal, leaving the California law intact and clearing the way for enforcement. The law went into effect in September 2012.
Also today, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of allowing closely held corporations to refuse specific birth control coverage for their female employees based on the religious beliefs of the company's owners. The decision only applies to closely held corporations, which the IRS defines as having more than 50% of its stock owned by five or fewer individuals. The decision says the 2010 Affordable Care Act violates a 1993 law guaranteeing religious freedom and notes that Congress defines corporations as people and says only closely held corporations are affected, even though that includes most companies in the United States. Hobby Lobby, Mardell Christian Stores, and the Conestoga Wood Specialties Corporation, a Mennonite woodworking business, brought the suit, citing objections to paying for what they call both birth control methods that are the same as abortion. Cecile Richards, president of Planned Parenthood Action Fund, says the company owners wrongly believe that these forms of birth control work after conception. She said, "You get to pick your opinion. You do not get to choose your facts." Jessica Gonzalez Rojas, executive director of the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health, NLIRH, released the following statement in response. "We are deeply disappointed in today's decision, which deals a serious blow to Latina health and religious liberty. It is terribly concerning that this decision opens the door for bosses to interfere with the personal health care decisions of their employees." Gonzalez Rojas says the fight is not over. White House spokesman Josh Earnest said the administration is trying to decide what to do now. "It is our view that Congress needs to take action to solve this problem that's been created, and the administration stands ready to work with them to do so," Earnest told reporters. President Obama believes that women should make personal health care decisions for themselves rather than their bosses deciding for them. "Today's decision jeopardizes the health of women that are employed by these companies." So, as of today, religious beliefs of a closely held business trump medical science and a woman's ability to make her own healthcare decisions, and corporations get to dictate that, according to the Supreme Court.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.immc.org for Monday, June 30th, 2014. Israeli bombardment leaves a Palestinian killed in Gaza. Meanwhile, Israeli troops attack West Bank communities and kidnap civilians. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. One Palestinian was killed and two were injured on Sunday evening after being struck by an Israeli missile east of the town of Carrara, northwest of Khan Yunis, in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. Local sources said that an Israeli drone fired a missile targeting a Hamas fighter while driving his motorcycle, killing him and wounding two bystanders. The slain Palestinian, Mohammed Zayed Abu Rizq, 22, is a member of Al-Qassam Brigades, the army of Hamas. In addition, Israeli tanks fired three shells into Al-Qarrara town just as the residents were breaking their fast on the evening of the first day of the holy Muslim month of Ramadan. In the West Bank, four Palestinians, including a teenager, were kidnapped by Israeli forces on Monday in the West Bank district of Bethlehem, Hebron and Nablus, according to reports by local security sources. Settlers' attacks occurred also on farmlands near Bethlehem, causing excessive financial losses and property damage for local farmers. Later on Monday evening, Israeli sources announced that the bodies of the three Israeli settlers who went missing 19 days ago were found near the southern West Bank village of Halhul in the Hebron district. The Israeli army announced that the three teens were killed and their bodies were moved to the coroner's office for further investigation. The three settlers went missing on June 13th as they were traveling from an illegal Israeli settlement near Hebron to Jerusalem. Shortly after, the Israeli army launched a wide-scale campaign targeting the West Bank and Gaza. Israeli troops killed eight Palestinian civilians and kidnapped at least 600 others during these attacks. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, June 30th, 2014, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imnc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bamoura.
In response to a few shells fired from the Gaza Strip, Israel's Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman proposed a full reoccupation of Gaza. The Israeli Air Force bombed two locations in the Gaza Strip. One target was a plastics factory in Sderot, which burned to the ground. Three factory workers were hospitalized with minor injuries. The IDF claims it only targeted weapons manufacturing sites, underground rocket launchers, and centers of terrorist activity.
In Iraq,
the Sunni militant group leading a rebellion against the Iraqi government has declared a Muslim caliphate in the parts of Syria and Iraq under its control. In a statement, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, known as ISIS or ISIL, said it will now be known simply as the Islamic State. The group also called on Islamist functions worldwide to pledge allegiance to the Islamic State. Iraqi lawmakers are holding a key session on Tuesday to begin selecting a new government. This comes as the Iraqi army has launched a new offensive to retake the northern city of Tikrit. A spokesperson for the United Nations Refugee Agency said aid officials have been unable to reach tens of thousands of displaced Iraqis. In a show of nascent sovereignty, an IS propaganda video shows a group tearing up their passports as if to say, "We don't need these anymore." In addition to the 300 advisors sent to Iraq last week, the U.S. is now sending an additional 300 soldiers, bringing the total to about 800 troops.
Over the weekend, more than 5,000 people were rescued by the Italian Navy. These refugees are fleeing the harsh conditions and violence in northern African nations in the Middle East. The boats they arrive on are often rickety and overcrowded. 30 corpses were found, apparently from drowning or suffocation, on the overcrowded boats. More than 5,000 people were rescued this weekend, adding to the 50,000 migrants who have reached Italy from North Africa so far this year, many fleeing war and conscription. Italy expects more to come and is asking for the EU to help manage the influx. In 2011, a record 62,000 refugees arrived in Italy. This record will be easily surpassed this year.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Rosalyn Scott, Ken Jones, Alexi Horowitz, and Jim Thompson. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elective representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kitzhaber's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Rosalyn Scott. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on the Abe and Joe Talk radio show, the hosts look at the Supreme Court's Hobby Lobby decision and its effect on women. At 9, an alternative radio professor and author, Richard Wolff, speaks on naked capitalism. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Stage and Studio, DeMay Roberts welcomes Tara Mathurne, artistic director of Conduit Dance in downtown Portland. She'll tell us about the Dance Summer Festival of curated multidisciplined dance with veteran and emerging performers. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Eva Lake interviews artist Teresa Wheel, who has a portrait project called Because She Cares, paintings of women nonprofit leaders. One of her portraits is of KBOO's co-manager, Monica Beamer. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support for community radio. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And now stay tuned for a live interview with a Portland Rising Tide activist who stopped an oil train for 4 hours this morning.
This morning, climate justice activists with Portland Rising Tide shut down the ARC Logistics crude oil terminal in Northwest Portland, resulting in one arrest. Portland resident Irene Maggiore, 22, locked herself to a 55-gallon barrel filled with concrete. That was placed on the railroad track leading into the facility. We're joined now by Emma with Portland Rising Tide, live in the studio to talk about this morning's action. First, Emma, welcome to KBOO and thanks for coming into the studio.
Thank you so much for having me on. Irene is out of jail and doing really well, but she was incredibly exhausted. She's had a really long day, as you can imagine, and so she didn't want to come in today. But it's been an exciting day for everyone at Portland Rising Tide.
Oh, thanks, Emma. First, let's talk about the target for this morning's action. Why ARC Logistics?
Well, they're an oil distribution terminal right here in Portland, and they've been operating since January. There was no permitting process to say, like, yeah, we as citizens of Portland want a oil terminal operating within our boundaries. They took over another facility that had previously been used for other purposes. Oil by rail is expanding wildly fast in the Pacific Northwest. In Oregon alone, it's grown 250% in the year 2013. So this is a huge issue, and those rail trains are unsafe for the communities that they pass through. And burning of oil and the massive increase in fossil fuel production is unsafe at large.
The location selected was a track used by oil trains to reach a yard where oil is offloaded. How did the action actually succeed in preventing oil trains from reaching their destination?
Absolutely. Well, a young woman locked her arm into a concrete barrel and was on the tracks. It was a feeder track that services that facility from the BNSF rail yard nearby, up there in Northwest Industrial Portland and Northwest Front Avenue. If anyone is familiar with that location.
And this is what I read earlier when researching the story is that you were there for about 4 hours before the police were called.
The police were on site, I'd say, within an hour. But the blockade held and the rail line was blocked for about 4 hours. Portland Rising Tide is one of, you know, there's a number of groups who are concerned about this issue of oil by rail, and there is a lot of there's a lot of concern broadly across in local communities and elsewhere about the safety of oil. We at Portland Rising Tide think that no oil transport is safe in the era of climate change and the rapid increase in oil production and transport, and attempts by a large industry to turn this region of the world and the Columbia River Gorge and Portland itself into a fossil fuel corridor should be resisted.
And that's exactly the next question here. We know that increased extraction in North Dakota's Bakken Shale has resulted in a dramatic rise in oil train traffic. That was part of our story earlier, with 250% more oil trains traveling Oregon rail lines in 2013 than in the previous year. So this is only increasing, and actually by quite a bit. We want to know, what are some of the impacts of this increase in oil trains on the environment here in Oregon?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, a lot of the dialogue has been about the safety of oil trains because they do explode, and oil trains have exploded and killed people. Actually, it's been almost a year anniversary on July 6th of an explosion in Quebec that killed 47 people. But in general, like, those rail lines are going up and down the gorge and really threatening one of the beautiful, wild, and scenic places we have in this region. And then at large, massive increase in fossil fuel production is not a way that I think our society needs to go. We need to wean ourselves off of fossil fuels. We need to not massively boost and distribute and consume more oil.
So exactly, how did Marjorie lock down on the tracks in this morning's action?
There was a barrel of concrete that was placed next to the tracks so that she could not be moved. And she locked herself to the barrel right next to the tracks and was sitting on the tracks. So she wasn't locked to the tracks proper, but she was obstructing train traffic on those tracks that service the ARC Logistics facility.
Now, this seems kind of like a crazy question, because I think the answer is yes. Was she in any danger at any point during the action?
Yes, I mean, direct action is always risky business. I'd say that in general, the most dangerous suspects on the scene, as always, are the police. But great pains were made to notify the rail yard and ARC Logistics as well that someone was blocking their tracks. I know that, like, her and our intention at Portland Rising Tide was to have a situation that was safe for her, but that stopped rail traffic in the region.
So do you know who called the police, who notified the police?
My understanding from being down there on site a little bit this morning was that some ARC Logistics people came and asked folks to leave the area, and then obviously Irene did not because her arm was in a concrete barrel, so I assumed that they did. But prior to all of that, great efforts had been made to notify the rail line that someone was on the tracks.
And from the story, we know that the bomb squad apparently showed up, and they were the ones who used tools to separate Irene from the barrel. Why did they send the bomb squad? Was there some kind of threat or anything like that? Was that just something the police decided to do on their own?
I have no idea. I assume it's something the police decided to do on their own. For all I know, it's because highly dangerous oil trains are moving through the area. I mean, again, activists on the... We're all unsafe here in Portland from the transport of oil trains. Those things explode, and they are moving through the city limits. So that in and of itself is what's highly unsafe from our perspective on the situation. I don't know why they sent the bomb squad. They might have the tools needed. This was a nonviolent protest, and, you know...
I was just wondering if they had thought that, again, it seems kind of absurd, but if they had thought that the barrel was a bomb and not full of concrete. And
I don't know. It was made clear that, you know, we were peacefully obstructing traffic, rail traffic, but beyond that, I don't know why they choose to make that decision.
So when the police arrived, what exactly did they do? What did they start? I mean, what was their first action when the police arrived?
They showed up, and they were in their car, and I believe on, you know, their, like, screen commuter monitors for a while. They approached the area and asked folks to leave, and Irene, you know, was locked to a barrel and not intending to leave and intending to block rail traffic for as long as possible. You know, again, a lot of these projects are flying in without public process, without permitting process, with little oversight. There's little permitting that goes on in the era of climate change about the continued use and consumption and transport of and processing of fossil fuels in general. And so, you know, I think that in a situation like that, we find that people are going to take direct action themselves to stop.
So how did the police disconnect her from the barrel of concrete that she was attached to? How did they do that?
Yeah, they tipped the barrel over on its side at one point. At one point, they were thinking about moving it with some trucks, which did seem quite unsafe and was probably the most unsafe moment of the day for Irene. They carved into the barrel, which was cement as well, is mixed with, like, some styrofoam for padding and space reasons, and then, like, sawed her out of the barrel and then eventually out of the metal sleeve that her arm was in.
And just to check, we have David on the phone line. Danielle, did you want to patch him in? Okay. David? Hello? You're calling KABU?
Yes, hi, I am here.
Oh, David, I'm sorry. Why are you calling in?
Yeah, we just got a note that you were on the line.
Yeah, so. I'm sorry. We don't really have the prep for this, but Daniel
no
said you were
I think y'all are great with the person you're talking to. Y'all called me about joining for an interview, so you're talking to the right person, so I think that I'll leave you in good hands.
Okay. I'm sorry for the mix-up. Thanks, David. We'll continue.
Continue your good conversation.
Oh, great. We'll continue talking with Emma. And again, Emma, thanks for coming down to the studio and joining us.
Thank you so much for having us on.
I just want to verify then, nobody was arrested at the scene other than Irene?
No, there was one arrest today. Other people cleared the tracks when. But yeah, Irene was the only person.
Okay, and what
today.
What are the official charges against Irene?
Let me see if my memory serves. Three misdemeanor charges: criminal trespass, disorderly conduct, and criminal mischief.
All misdemeanors.
All misdemeanors. Oh. Yeah, and Irene has been released on her own recognizance and is being arraigned tomorrow at 1:45. Right down at the downtown there.
And just before we go to the next question, with misdemeanors, what's the worst that can happen? A fine, probably no jail sentence, I would imagine.
I do think that a jail sentence is possible with misdemeanors, but you know, Irene has the full support of other people and loyals, pro bono lawyers around town. So she has a great legal support team. Usually with misdemeanor activist charges like this, you see like some fines and probation, possibly community service, those kind of charges, but not jail time. Although you never know.
Right. So what's the current status of the proposed oil train terminals in Oregon?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are two there are two functioning oil distribution terminals, and I know that I've hit this point before, but you know those terminals are operating without like really a public input. And there's the ARC Logistic distribution terminal here in Northwest Portland, and there's also the in Clatskanie, Oregon, there is the Port Westward facility. The Port Westward facility was publicly subsidized. It was an ethanol processing plant. And then after a year when that was not financially profitable for them, they switched over and became an oil distribution terminal. And then we have just across the river in Vancouver, there's another major proposed oil terminal, as well as there's multiple functioning, up and running and being constructed and proposed oil terminals up in Washington State as well. They're really trying to move this Bakken shale through this region and trying to turn the Northwest into a dirty fuels corridor.
And as we mentioned, those imports or trips are increasing all the time from North Dakota.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Huge, massive increase, 70-fold since 2006.
Now Governor Kitzhaber, he would have some jurisdiction on the Oregon side at least, and not some of these new Washington terminals. He's expressed concern about this expansion of oil exports. Has he taken any action so far to stop the expansion?
Not that I know of. I know that the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, the Port Westward facility was operating illegally at above their legally permitted capacity. And the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality responded by giving them a small fine comparative to the amount of money that they were making, and telling them that they would expedite their further permitting process, you know, saying, oh, we notice you're operating illegally. If you could, we're just going to give you a little fine. And then in the future, if you could get a permit for that, was essentially their response, not a response to shut down or anything like that, shut down the facility. And so I don't know what Governor Kitzhaber's response will be on this. It's a lot easier for a politician to talk big talk. And there's not decisive action by Governor Kitzhaber or really few, if any, politicians on the issue of climate change.
Just one follow-up then. So nothing in the legislature currently, in the Oregon legislature, to stop or halt or decrease these oil trips?
Not to my knowledge. My understanding is that the Oregon Department of Transportation has actually given a little bit of money to potentially improve some rail lines and make it a little bit safer. But there's nothing that I know of. I think there's been potentially a little bit of talk, potentially just about activists, about oil by rail moratorium in the state. But I no decisive actions by Governor Kitzhaber at the moment. And then in conditions like this, where, you know, citizens are not given input in the process, and these projects happen without either governmental or public oversight, you know, people will take direct action themselves to shut down these unsafe facilities.
Amazingly enough, in the last 3 years, there seems to be an average of 9 train derailments per month. I mean, 9 per month. And this is according to a study by the Sightline Institute. So what are the, I mean, obviously, a train derailment with an oil train, I mean, that can be very dangerous. But, I mean, give us some specifics on what has happened and what else can happen.
In terms of, well, like I mentioned before, right. I mean, the most notorious incident was in Quebec, Canada, where 47 people died in an oil train explosion. And that happened July 6th of last year. That one-year anniversary is almost upon us. I mean, when you're talking about the Bakken oil shale, you're talking about a process to remove and transport and then burn massive amounts of oil, which I don't think our planet can handle in this era of climate change. And so those oil cars themselves are highly dangerous. They can explode. They could spill in the Columbia River. Any number of like imminent threats from the oil by rail itself. But ultimately, we're talking about catastrophic climate crisis if that oil is burned.
Oh, Emma, I only have a little time left, and I really appreciate you coming down again. I had two questions, and I'll try to combine them. One, I think some of our listeners might be asking themselves, what are the alternatives to oil and coal that Rising Tide promotes? And then if people want to get involved with Portland Rising Tide, how can they do that?
Well, absolutely. I think that your first question is really such a long one. I mean, I think that we can transition to, we are the human society that consumes the most resources ever on this planet. There are plenty of alternatives in every other human society that has ever existed. Portland Rising Tide, check us out on the internet, check us out on